The book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes was written by, probably, Solomon. And the book in Hebrew is called Kohelet. And in the Septuagint, remember that is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. It is essentially Ecclesiastes. Now, does anybody know what those two words mean? This is a little tricky. It means the preacher, or the one who gathers as if to preach. The Greek word for the church is ekklesia, and so you can kind of see how Ecclesiastes would be related to that. And I always wondered, why in the world is it called Ecclesiastes, the preacher, when it's in the Old Testament? Because didn't they have like priests and prophets and stuff like that, but not pastors and preachers? Well, yes, that's true. But he calls himself the preacher, and you could make a pretty good case that the book of Ecclesiastes is something of a sermon from the king to his people. He has gathered them together and has insight for life. It was probably written, since we have already said that it was written by Solomon, it was probably written during Solomon's lifetime, which means 970 to 931 BC. I tend to think that it was very late in Solomon's life, perhaps even his last words. In 2 Samuel, we have David's last words addressed to the nation. He sort of gathers them together and sends them on, understanding that his public ministry and his public life is essentially over at that point. But I think Solomon wrote this at the very least late in his life. Look at Ecclesiastes 1. We see that this is probably Solomon as the author. It's the best understanding to take, I think. The words of the preacher, that's where we get Kohelet or Ecclesiastes, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So he was the son of David and he is king in Jerusalem. Remember now some of the background about Solomon that will help us understand the significance of what he's going to say to us in Ecclesiastes. Come back to 1 Kings chapter 1, or excuse me, 1 Kings chapter 3. 1 Kings chapter 3. The book of 1 Kings opens with Solomon ascending to and really solidifying his place on the throne over Israel. And Solomon has essentially done that. And one day he is worshiping. He's offering sacrifices at Gibeon. And I think he recognizes something of the vast nature of his task as the ruler of God's people. Because on that day, 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 5, in Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night. And God said, "Ask what you wish me to give you." Then Solomon said, "You have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, according as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward you. You have reserved for him this great loving kindness that you have given him a son to sit on the throne, as it is this day. Now, O Lord, my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David. Yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or to come in. Your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people who are too many to be numbered or counted. So give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?" So Solomon, given the opportunity to ask for anything, anything he wants, long life, victory over his enemies, great wealth, any of these things, Solomon says, "God, you have placed me in a place of great responsibility and great difficulty. Give me wisdom, wisdom to rule over your people justly, wisdom to rule over them righteously and correctly. And the writer says it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life or nor asked for riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but you have asked for yourself discernment to understand justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, nor shall there be one like, nor shall one arise or one like you arise after you. I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you in all your days. If you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. So God says, Solomon, because you have asked what is pleasing in my sight, because you have asked for wisdom, this good thing in leading and ruling my people, not only am I going to give you greater wisdom than anyone in the history of the world has ever had, or anyone in the history of the world ever will have, I'm also going to give you wealth and glory and honor and fame, and if you're obedient, I will give you a long life as well. What this does, it does indeed make Solomon wiser than all the others, and it also gave him the resources to do whatever he wanted. All right? The next six chapters of 1 Kings go on and talk about the greatness of Solomon, his fame, his wealth, his fortune, his honor, his prosperity, and the prosperity that he brings to the kingdom in Israel. It talks about silver and gold just kind of laying around on the streets because it's so plentiful. Anything that Solomon wanted, he could do. Nothing was beyond his abilities mentally. He had the capacity to do or understand anything that he put his mind to. Nothing was beyond his resources to do financially. Anything he decided he wanted, anything he decided he wanted to build, any program he decided he wanted to start, he could do it. So if there was ever a man in the history of the world qualified to write the book of Ecclesiastes, it was Solomon. So come back to the beginning of Ecclesiastes, and we'll see what it is that Solomon did, how he went about life. He demonstrated all of these things. He demonstrated his wisdom. He demonstrated his power. He demonstrated his fame. He demonstrated his prowess and his glory and his fame. He demonstrated all of these things in spades. And what he decided that he was going to do was he decided ultimately that he was going to do an experiment. He says, okay, I have all of these resources. I want to see if there is anything on earth, anything in the world, anything that this world has to offer that can bring happiness and satisfaction and fulfillment and everything else. I'm a man who, more than any other person in the history of the world, is able to do this, can do this. I want to see if it's possible to gain satisfaction and fulfillment from the things that this world has to offer. Because Solomon says, if this world has it to offer, then I can get it. It is accessible to me, both financially, resources-wise, glory and fame-wise, power-wise, and intellectually. And here is his conclusion in all of this. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. He ultimately says that nothing on earth can ultimately bring fulfillment and satisfaction. Here is the purpose of the book. He says, in spite of seeming futility involved in man's existence, because what Solomon's going to do, we're going to see, is he's going to look everywhere under the sun for satisfaction and fulfillment, and he is going to come to the conclusion that everything under the sun is futile. It's vain. That word vanity, it's like, we'll talk about it in just a little bit, but it's like the steam that rises up a cup of coffee. It's there and it's gone. But in spite of this seeming futility involved in man's existence, the wise man should fear God and enjoy life as a gift from God. Now, that may seem a little paradoxical, right? You're saying, but Solomon, you've said that everything under the sun, everything in this life is futile. How do I enjoy it? We'll get there. All right? So that's the purpose of the book, and the major theme becomes the futile way versus the fruitful way. The futile way of life versus the fruitful way of life. Now, let's consider in the outline how it is that Solomon develops this thought. Okay? How does this thought develop? Well, in chapter 1, verses 1 through 11, the prologue to the book, if you will, you have the problem set forth. And that is the fact that all is vanity. That is the fact that all is vanity. And he states the problem outright, right at the beginning. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? What advantage does man have in all of his work that he does under the sun? This is sort of asking the question to an answer that he's going to give. It's kind of like Jeopardy. I stole that. I heard that in a sermon I listened to yesterday. But it's kind of like Jeopardy, right? First you get the answer, and then you have to ask the question on Jeopardy. That's why they always say, what is this and that and the other thing? And that's why Alex always says, answer, when they ask for the... Never mind. All right. Jeopardy nerd. But he gives us the answer that to the question that he's going to ask. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? And the answer he gives here is there is no advantage. To all the work that man does under the sun, there is no advantage. He goes on for the next six chapters then, and he proves that all the work done under the sun is vanity. Everything that is done under the sun. Now remember that term, under the sun. That's key. And that's going to help us through what we're going to see. But all the work that anyone ever does, no matter how good or how bad, all the work done under the sun, it's futile. Solomon says it's chasing after the wind. Now, Solomon, in the next section of the book, chapters 1 through 6, essentially, he gives us proof that everything is vanity. He proves to us that everything done under the sun is vain. It is transient and it's ultimately useless. He knows this first by experience. Like we said, Solomon, of all people in the history of the world, is qualified to write this book because there is nothing that Solomon did not have access to. By experience, he says, all is vanity. In his pursuits, he sees, look at chapter 1, verse 12, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven, and it is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. Skip down to chapter 2, verse 1, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. He says, I've sought out all wisdom in earth. I've sought out all pleasure on earth. Chapter 2, verse 12. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness, or wisdom, madness and folly. For what will man do who will come after the king except what has already been done? You see there the vast range of things that Solomon has pursued. Everything that could have to do with wisdom and understanding and foolishness, everything that could have to do with any experience that you could ever have, Solomon says, there is nothing that anyone has ever done or ever will be able to do that I haven't in effect done. And the conclusion of all of this is that it's vanity. Look at chapter 2, verse 18. Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. For I must leave it to man who will come after me. Solomon says everything that you could pursue in this life, whether good or bad, whether achieving or failure to achieve, all of this stuff, the entire range of things, what you accomplish and experience on this earth, once you die, not yours anymore. It doesn't matter how much wealth you accrue, how much wisdom you attain to. It doesn't matter how many things that you have. It doesn't matter how much pleasure you've experienced. At the end of the day, when we die, under the sun, it's all going to somebody else. You've ultimately gained nothing by it. And Solomon says, I came to this realization, and so I hated life. And I hated everything that I did, and I hated all the fruit of my labor. So by way of experience, Solomon says that all is vanity. We also see that Solomon says this by way of observation. So Solomon says, this is not just me who comes to this conclusion. I can also see this come to fruition in other people over and over and over. As I look and see at the way that the world is, at the way that life goes for people, I see that life is vanity. Look at chapter 4 in verse 1. And you'll see here, remember he said, I put my mind to do this, to think this, to experience this. In chapter 4, we're going to see now that he is looking. Chapter 4, verse 1, Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead who had already died. Look at chapter 4, verse 4. I have seen that every labor and every skill which is done is the result of rivalry between a man and his neighbor. This too is vanity, striving after the wind. Chapter 5, verse 8. If you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official, and there are higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. So what is Solomon saying? He's saying, I'm looking at the world around me, and I can tell just from watching the way things are, and you should be able to tell just from watching the way that things are, that life under the sun is vanity. It is fruitless. And he gives a summary of all of these things. We're going to read chapter 6. Chapter 6. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun and is prevalent among man. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires. Yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many they be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say better is the miscarriage than he. For it comes in futility and goes into obscurity, and its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun and it never knows anything. It is better off than he. Even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy good things, who do not all go to one place? You see what he's saying here? He's saying, even if you have the best of everything, once you die, it's done. It's over. A man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage does a wise man have over the fool? What advantage does a poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? What the eye sees is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility in striving after the wind. Whatever exists has already been named, and it is known what man is. For he cannot dispute with him who is stronger than he. For there are many words which increase futility. What then is the advantage to a man? For who knows what is good for a man during his lifetime, during the few years of his futile life? He will spend them like a shadow. For who can tell a man what will be after him under the sun? Solomon says, look, even if you have the best of everything in life, or if you have the worst of everything in life, ultimately we're all going to the same place, we're all dying under the sun. It's vain. It all comes out as a wash in the end. So Solomon in verses 7 through 11 then gives the prescription, because all is vanity. He gives some advice for living in light of the vanity of this life, in light of the transience and the futility of this life. He tells us first how to cope in a wicked world. Look at chapter 7, verses 13 through 18. Consider the work of God, for who is able to straighten what he has bent? In the day of prosperity, be happy, but in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not discover anything that will be after him. I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness. There is a wicked man who prolongs his life in wickedness. Do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked. Do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp the one thing. This is probably in reference to prosperity. And also not let go of the other. Difficulty, trial, hardship, adversity. For the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Okay. Coping in the wicked world, he says, understand that life is going to bring prosperity and adversity. Fear God in life and embrace both prosperity and adversity. That's how you cope with a wicked world. He also gives counsel in light of the uncertainty of this world. Come over to chapter 11, look at verses 1 through 6. Cast your bread on the surface of the waters, for you will find it after many days. Divide your portion to 7 or even to 8. For you do not know what misfortune may occur on the earth. If the clouds are full, they pour out rain upon the earth, and whether a tree falls forward or toward the south or toward the north, wherever the tree falls, there it lies. He who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. Just as you do not know the path of the wind and how the bones are formed in the womb of the pregnant woman, so you do not know the activity of God who makes all things. Sow your seed in the morning and do not be idle in the evening. For you do not know whether morning or evening sowing will succeed or whether both of them alike will be good. So he says, do your best, diversify your assets, and work hard. Don't try and make all the decisions based on is it going to be a good season for doing this or a bad season for doing this. Do what you know you need to do. Trust the Lord and embrace what the Lord brings. So there is some practical wisdom for living in a world that is futile, that is vanity. Anybody depressed yet? He says, look, life's going to be hard. Sometimes it's going to be good. There's not much you can do about it, and it's all a wash in the end. But what's the key? Where have we looked so far? We are still under the sun, right? Solomon has looked everywhere under the sun and said, it's vanity. Unless, and I intentionally didn't sprinkle these passages in, he sprinkles in from time to time, he inserts in from time to time, a godly worldview, a godly attitude, and a godly manner of thinking within the world under the sun. And what it does is it carries our attention above and beyond the place of under the sun. And that's what we get to. He brings it to full force in conclusion. Excuse me, I forgot to put in the conclusion. All right. Chapter 12 really is the conclusion. And let's take a look. What does he say? In light of all of this, chapter 12, verse 1, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you will say, I have no delight in them. Come down to chapter 12, verse 13, the conclusion. When all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. Do you want to know how to make life substantial under the sun? Do you want to know how to live a fruitful life, how to walk the fruitful way in a futile world? It is to live in such a way that you fear the Lord. It is to understand who is in control of all things, to submit to Him, and to enjoy the things that he gives us, to enjoy the things that he gives us, and to trust him, whether in times of prosperity or times of adversity. And we've seen this built, actually, throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. Come back to chapter 2. Every time he gets to the end of what he's done and what he's observed, every time that he comes to the end of a section, he says, every time I look at things under the sun and try and find happiness and try and find meaning and try and find purpose and try and find fulfillment in anything on the earth, I'm driven over and over and over again to the conclusion that the only way that life is worth living, the only way that life has any meaning, the only way that life has any purpose is when I live in light of the fear of the Lord. Chapter 2, verse 24 says, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. So what does he understand? What brings weight to the vanity of life? What brings purpose to the futility of life? What brings fruit to the futility of life? It's understanding that whatever we have in life, whatever things that we have in this world, whatever comes, prosperity or adversity, work or pleasure or pain or happiness, it's from the hand of God. It's from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? For to a person who is good in his sight, he is given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while to the sinner he is given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. Come over to chapter 3, look at verses 12 and 13. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is a gift of God. So even here, man's work, man's labor is a gift from God. Come over to chapter 5, verse 18. Here's what I've seen. Remember what we saw is the theme in chapters 4, 5, and 6? This is what I see, right? I have observed life, and it says that life under the sun is vanity. But here's what I've seen. To be good and fitting, to eat, to drink, and to enjoy oneself in all one's labor in which he toils under the sun, during the few years of his life which God has given him, for this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart. So again, Solomon says, enjoy the labor that God has given you in this futile life. Come over to chapter 12. We see in the again, here we take a look at the conclusion. Verse 13, the conclusion when all has been heard is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. Now, what we see in verse 14 is that when we fear the Lord, that will guide how we navigate life under the sun. Because what happens when we fear the Lord? He says, for God will bring every act to judgment. A major part of fearing the Lord is understanding this fact, that God will bring everything that we do to judgment. So Solomon has spent an awful lot of time saying that under the sun, as we consider life apart from the Lord, when we think through what advantage is it to be righteous, what disadvantage really is there in being wicked? Everybody dies anyway. Death is the great equalizer at the end of the day, right? And Solomon says, not when we understand life in the fear of the Lord. Because we understand that God will bring everything to judgment. Everything back in verse 14, which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. So that's the overarching theme of the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon says, I have looked at life under the sun. I have looked at life from every aspect as far as under the sun goes, as far as apart from God goes. And from an earthly perspective, there is no real advantage to being righteous or to being wicked. There's no real advantage to being wealthy or being poor. There's no real advantage to being wise or to being foolish, because at the end of the day, death comes, and it's the great equalizer. And once death comes, as far as this earth is concerned, it's over. It's done. Everything that we've accumulated goes to someone else. Everything that we have lost, oh well, who cares? You're dead. The only way to find meaning and purpose, Solomon says, in life is to live it in light of the truth of who God is. And then to enjoy life. To enjoy life. I love the book of Ecclesiastes because that's the conclusion. Fear God and enjoy the good things that God has given. It's not Epicurean. That is to say, it's not, the point here isn't to just get everything that you can and really just do only things that are fun and avoid pain at all costs. Solomon says, no, when we fear the Lord, we embrace both prosperity and adversity. And we can find joy in both sides of the equation because we understand that God is the one who is in control, that God is the one who will bring all things to judgment. And that's how we can live in a wicked world. That's how we can live in a crooked world, in a perverse world, where sometimes the righteous man is killed young and sometimes the wicked man lives for a long, long time. We understand that it's God who's in control, that it's me who's not, and that God is the one who will reward all things appropriately. Now, the major themes, what are the things that Solomon sort of develops as he moves through the book? This idea of vanity, obviously, is very, very important in the book. The meaning is vapor, like I said, like the steam, you know, the steam that comes off your cup of coffee in the morning. I say yours because it's definitely not mine. But that little steam thing that comes up and then it gets to the top of the cup and maybe a little farther and then it's gone, right? That's the idea of that word vanity. It's futile. There's no weight to anything in that steam. And it identifies, when Solomon says everything here, everything in life is vanity, or pursuits are vanity, what he's saying is that life is transient and it ultimately adds up to nothing. How much of that vapor would you have to gather together to get a pound of vapor, a pound of anything? That's a fairly small amount, right? It would take tons and tons and tons of it, right? Yeah, maybe Eric, there's a calculation for you to do for us. Figure out how much of that. But that's the point, right? It would take so much. There's nothing to this. And when Solomon talks about it being vain and vanity, in fact, what Solomon says when he says vanity of vanities, remember I said in Hebrew, the superlative is built like this. So it's the vainest. If you took all of the vanities of the world, if you took all of the things that are weightless and have no real significance in all of the earth, in everything under the sun, and you put them all on the table, this one would stand out. This would be the ultimate vanity, the ultimately weightless thing. That maybe means it would float or something, I don't know. But this is the thing that's ultimately weightless, and life, Solomon says, it's weightless. The things that go along with vanity, he talks about striving after the wind. He says there's no ultimate profit in it. There's no advantage to all of these things. This is the ultimate evaluation of life considered apart from the fear of the Lord. And so that life considered apart from the fear of the Lord, that concept is given the term of under the sun. It says, when I consider all of the things under the sun, I'm talking about life apart from the fear of the Lord. Life here on earth, especially apart from thinking about who God is. Also, death becomes a very important concept in Ecclesiastes, because as far as life under the sun is concerned, death is the great equalizer, right? It's the end of the day. It's the fate of all people. It's the fate of the wise man and the fool. It's the fate of the rich man and the poor. It's the fate of the good man and the evil. And this is the reason to fear God and enjoy life. Because ultimately under the sun, death brings equality for us all. But you have to understand that life goes beyond just death, and that God will bring all things to judgment. It's ultimately, this death is why life under the sun doesn't bring happiness or satisfaction, because it'll all go away when you die. It's done. The wicked can't take it with them. The righteous will be wise, and the wise will leave it all behind. Ultimately, though, we will stand before the Lord in judgment. And for believers, there's special significance to that. We'll stand before Christ and the Bema Seat. And you know what it talks about? It says that everything that we do in this life of vanity, it will be placed on the fire. And everything that was worthwhile, everything that had weight, everything that had significance, in other words, everything that was done to build on the foundation that has been laid for Christ, that will stand. And there is significance to that. And there will be reward for that that goes on into eternity. Everything else goes up in smoke. There you go, smoke. The steam that rises, vanity. Everything that's done in light of life under the sun will be vanity. But everything that's done in the fear of the Lord, even the things that we enjoy, even the things that we like, even the fun that we have, if we recognize it as a gift from God, as goodness from God, then it will stand, it will have weight. Solomon talks about labor, toil, and work. It's what man does, it's his lot in general. Apart from God, our labor and work is futile. But when we recognize that labor is from the Lord, it's fruit, and the labor that we have, we understand, is a gift from the Lord. And we can enjoy the labor that he gives us. And we're allowed to, in light of the fact that it is a gift from God, enjoy the fruit of the labor that we do here on earth. That's how a believer looks at life and the good things in life and the wonderful gifts that God gives us and the pleasure and the joy and the happiness and the nice things that God has blessed us with. The believer makes those things weighty, not by finding his satisfaction in those things, but as recognizing those things as a good and perfect gift from the hand of the God from whom all good and perfect gifts come. The heart of the conclusion, ultimately, is to fear God. And we've talked a great deal, at great length, about why that is so important. Fear God because he will judge. And when we understand that God will bring every act to judgment, then we will have that as the central important thought in life. It takes us beyond under the sun, where everything is vanity, and brings life into its proper perspective. Brings life into its proper perspective. And when we have life in proper perspective, we get to enjoy life. We get to enjoy the good things that God has given. We get to enjoy the labor that the Lord has entrusted us. We get to enjoy good gifts from his perfect hand, even in a world that is filled with futility and injustice. Our time is up for this morning, so let's pray. Father, we thank you so much for this book of Ecclesiastes, and we thank you for the perspective that it lends to our lives. Lord, as we look around and we see that the world doesn't work like it should, we see that sin and wickedness and evil often prevail. We know and understand that ultimately those things will be brought to judgment, that you rule still, that you reign, and that we can live a life that is weighty and meaningful when we live it in a fear of you. Lord, we look forward to the day when your Son will return, when he will rule and reign, when this life will not be futile, when this world and even the things under the sun will not be futile, because your Son will indeed be under the sun. Lord, may that day come quickly, and may we be prepared. We pray these things in your Son's precious name. Amen.